This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling, JT Allen. This is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the best!
I carry my life around with me in a see-through bag, and you got the fucking order. Ask me why the fuck I'm at. Different stages, different faces I see. Up in the crowd, it's them same ass fools that say my mind's in the cloud.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 17 of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, joined as always by that chap called Alan. And Alan, how are you today, good sir?
I am doing well, good sir. I'm very, very well indeed. I've been trying to follow what's been going on in the world of wrestling this weekend. This past weekend has been a bit of a hectic one in the world of the indie wrestling. Some dick spots, some no sells, some SCI tournaments in Chattanooga. It's been a busy old weekend. But I've had a chance to do a bit of research for the show, and there's been some fun questions hopefully we can cover in this show, JT. So shall we get to it?
Yeah, why not? It's about time that we dive into that plunder bucket as we take our trip around the nostalgia mothership Outer Rim, as we do each and every week.
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Okay, the first question this week is, hello, JT and Alan. I'm a big fan of the show. With WWE just having a Punjabi prison match, it would be interesting to hear you two talk about the different type of cage matches WCW had over the years, such as the Tower of Doom, Chamber of Horrors, Regular Cage, Thunder Cage, War Games, etc. Which ones did you like and which ones did you not like? And that comes from Stefan in Sweden via email. So thank you very much for the question there, Stefan.
Yes.
So WCW cage matches varied over the years. I would say they were more varied than WWF. I think that's a bit of a fair statement to make straight off the bat, JT. I think, you know, we had a different variety.
Oh, for sure. They always seem, though we've talked about this in the past and it's been covered, that WCW always seemed to be more willing to go outside the box, whether it's tying things in with different holidays or, you know, trying different gimmicks and different ideas. WWF always seemed much more set in their patterns and in their ways until they were forced out of them. But, yeah, I mean, WWF, gimmick match wise, they didn't really have much different than like cage and ladder until they were they went to the Hell in the Cell and then they brought them out from there. But for a while, it was pretty standard what they would do. But WCW definitely much more open to their different kind of cage matches, specifically, you know, beyond just regular gimmick matches. Yeah, I like that they always mix things up. And, you know, my PIC on the Place to Be podcast, Scott Criscolo, he always thinks that the reason Vince and WWE never did, like, War Games or any of these kind of things was because he was less willing to eat up extra floor space needed to fit these extra rings and cages that he's, you know, wants to sell those extra floor tickets. I mean, I don't know how definitive that is, but I would say it's plausible that they're less willing to sacrifice the money for the aesthetic, whereas WCW more prone to kind of not caring as much financially about stuff, maybe was more open to eating up that extra floor space. Do you think there's any validity to that idea?
I think so, definitely at the time there would have been, because you can see from the War Games match, you need two rings straight away, so it's going to be difficult for, you know, them to set. They're going to lose a few, you know, maybe a few hundred seats there potentially from a configuration, and also sight lines for the live audience. It's not as great if you're at the edge of one ring and the action's going on in the second ring, but they've kind of gone away from that completely now with the Punjabi prison match. That was unwatchable from a live perspective and audience, wasn't it? I don't really get that one because it was so difficult. It was like loads of lines over lines or cage over cage. So it just wasn't great. So nowadays they'll try different things, see what sticks. And it's the third time I think they did the Punjabi prison the past weekend with the Jinder Orton match, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, they hadn't done one since, I mean, it had been almost, 10 years or so at least since they last did one. I think it was 07. So yeah, whatever. It's not like something they break out all the time. It's fitting because they feel like if they have a Indian champion, they should go ahead and do that gimmick, I guess. And it was kind of funny they brought Kali in for it. But I mean, I think part of it too is in the past, Vince and the WWF has always been so much more of a visual TV-based product that they probably wanted to ensure, even more so than the fans in the arena being able to see, is that they were able to shoot it properly for TV and pay-per-view. WCW, again, seemed a little less concerned with that at times, so I wonder if that was part of it, too. And I know that has to be why partially they went to the big blue bars, right, and WWF it was better on TV. So I do wonder how much that played a role, too, without getting too convoluted with all different kinds of cages and fencing and stuff.
Yeah, I think the blue cage was easier to climb as well for a lot of the bigger guys around that time. I mean, even I think there was a show I was watching, or a gift, it was an On This Day one that I tweet out with Andre and Hogan. I think it was WrestleFest 88.
Yep.
And you actually have Andre climbing the cage.
Right.
Which,
he'll never do it. Yeah.
No, not at all. So I think there's a reason for that. But going back to the WCW cages, JT, what is your favorite one? What's your favorite type of cage?
It's got to be War Games. I mean, War Games is the most classic. It's iconic. One of the best WCW concepts that they ever did, especially when they had the right feud and the right blow-off to it, whether it's 92 with the Dangerous Alliance, 94, your favorite year, with the Stud Stable and the Rhodes family, and then even later on, even though the matches weren't as good, but the WCW NWO ones, of course, was a perfect feud for a setting like War Games, and even back to the Horsemen and all that stuff. So it was always both the best from an aesthetic point of view, from a concept point of view, and from, you know, fitting really well with the feuds.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think War Games would be the number one, but from a pure how it looked, I thought the Tower of Doom stroke triple cages looked good, but they're never going to get a good match inside them, unfortunately. They'll have weird rules why you had two guys. Like in the Tower of Doom one, there was a Great American Bash 88. They had two guys starting at the top in this little cage, and everyone else was underneath, and then they would have to fight for 2 minutes, and the cage door would open for 15 seconds. Then what they'd have to do is get a key from ringside, from whoever had the key. I think the manager at the time may have been Baby Doll. I can't remember who it was. But that was at the Great American Bash. It was all weird and convoluted. The same at the Uncensored show in 96. The Dungeons of Doom one, which we've talked about in length multiple times on this show. That, again, was kind of weird and convoluted. Different people in different cages. Really hard to follow. It looked good, but in execution, it wasn't too good. And another one that was not good at all was the Chamber of Horrors. Good, so bad it was good type category, but really, it was hokey as hell. WCW, for me, in 89, 90, it was more of a realistic product in certain ways, in ring especially, than in a WWF. But into 91, they were doing all these Jim Herd things. You had Chamber of Horrors, where you had Abdullah the Butcher get electrocuted by Cactus Jack, who thought that Rick Steiner, I think, was in the chair, and then he suplexed him out of it, and Abdullah was in there, and by the time Cactus Jack looked around, it was too late, and he was frying his tag partner. That was all a bit wild, but I did like in there, they had the cage cam. You had the referee cam inside.
Yes.
Inside that, if you remember. And that was something that I'd never seen WWF do around that time, so that was certainly different. I think WCW had done that before. I think even at the Havoc 89 cage match, which was that a Thunder cage match? With the Flair and Muta and Sting and
Yeah,
Funk.
I believe so, yep.
So the Thunder Cage one, JT, was it allegedly electrified along the top to stop people actually escaping at all?
Yeah, and that was more of the like the Hell in a Cell kind of setup, where they had the ring was the whole ringside area was inside the cage. That was kind of the first version of that. And then WCW also had, I guess, was it just the War Games that had the roof cage? Did they ever have a regular match inside a roof cage?
Yeah, they're gonna do. There was loads of forgettable ones into the late 90s. They were doing. Did the War Games, didn't they, on Nitro?
Yeah, that was the awful one. Yeah, with it was just teams of three or whatever. That was the last one. That one sucked.
They did all the kind of weird and wonderful cage matches, that era in Nitro, on Nitro. And then they did the triple cage match at, was it Slamboree, where Canyon took the fall. And then they did another one, I think, later on as well. So they're all sort of different ones. And they're not really memorable. But regular cage matches, I mean, the more memorable, I would say, in WWF than WCW. Would you think that's a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't even remember any big ones besides, I mean, Hogan Flair at Halloween Havoc 94 is probably the biggest one they did as far as just like a straight cage.
Yeah.
I mean, they did Hogan Piper. That's the infamous Age in a Cage from Havoc 97. They never did too many of them, I feel like. It was always usually gimmick-wise if they were going to do one. I'm sure we're missing some, but those are the ones I really mainly remember were those couple.
Yeah, I think the other the look of the Thunder Cage was as well. the cage was a lot higher than a normal cage, and also you couldn't climb over because it came in again, in slightly. So you'd have to, you know, like...
it's like a prison fence.
Yeah, like a prison fence is the best way. I mean, there was, getting off topic slightly, but my favourite kind of cage memory of wacky cages and climbing was it Homicide stuck on top of the cage in TNA.
Oh, yeah. that's a pretty famous one. That was on the, was that the first Monday Night Show, too? Wasn't that that one where they had, like, the weird cage with, like, the hole at the top? Isn't that where he got stuck?
Yeah, he got stuck in that, and he tried to, he couldn't escape. And he didn't
I think it was the first ever Monday Night Impact when they did the head-to-head. I'm pretty sure it was that night.
Yeah, well, getting off topic, that was a funny memory. But getting back to these cages then, just to wrap up the question, I would say my favourite, like yours, was War Games. The worst one, I would probably have to say, is Chamber of Horrors. I don't know, they only did it once, didn't they? So maybe they realised it wasn't too great themselves.
I didn't mind it, though. Like, I thought the match itself was pretty fun. And even though the end is ridiculous, like, it was a Halloween show. Like, I didn't mind them doing something a little campy, especially to start the show, so it's kind of out of the way. I mean, the only thing that probably... you could say that hurt it was that they wasted like a couple of main event guys in there. Like, why is Sting in that match? You know, but I guess he wasn't a full main eventer by that point. But was that 91 or 89?
And the Halloween Havoc, like, it was one in 91, and Meltzer gave that match minus 2 stars. It was LA Gonte, Sting, and the Steiner Brothers versus Abdullah the Butcher, Big Von Vader, Cactus Jack, and Diamond Stud. So there was a nice mix of talent there around that
I
era.
I think it was that bad. I don't know, may have misremembering. It's been a while since I've seen it, but. Anyway, I guess if you want to say it was hokey, and it's probably the worst, but I didn't mind that being hokey because they put it on the Havoc show and it was meant to be kind of creepy and weird. I think that the triple cage is probably the worst just because it's so convoluted. And like between that and the scaffold match, on paper, maybe they look cool, or in theory, like I remember as a kid, like when World Class was on ESPN, they did the triple cage too, right there. So I remember like toward the dying days, and I remember seeing it. It looked so amazing, and I wanted to see another match. But then you get to it, and it's like, it's just boring as hell, and you can't tell what's going on, when you can go into the door, when you can't, who's coming next. And the one in, the one they did in 96 obviously was even more of a disaster. But yeah, I would say that's probably my least favorite.
Just thinking of the cage matches that they did, and I'm going to put these on the playlist. We had Ron Simmons, Butch Reed. They had a cage match with Teddy Long in a shark cage at Super Bowl I.
I'll tell you what, in a cage match, you have to be prepared to use the cage. You have to use it to your advantage, and that will bring that victory home for you. Well, you'd be bleeding from your mouth, too, if you ate some of that steel right there, Jimbo, and I've ate it right here, and I know what it feels like. Reed's had a great game plan here. He's used the cage just enough. He's got Simmons on a bad road right here, brother. When you get on a bad road, you're looking for a good one.
And the split up of Doom, we had a random cage match on between Goldberg versus Scott Steiner. We were in a cage on Nitro, later on in Nitro era. I've got one on the playlist here, York Foundation versus Dustin Rhodes, Big Josh and Tom Zenk in a cage match in 91. DDP and Jeff Jarrett in a cage match.
I do remember that one, yeah.
So there's plenty of examples. There's some good ones here on the playlist for people to check out, so you should do that. So shall we go on now to the second question, JT?
Let's do it.
Okay. Hey, guys. I was a wee kid growing up, and when I finally discovered WCW, it was in the middle of the Black Scorpion story. Who was an evil magician that turned out to be Ric Flair? What was this supposed to be? Even as a kid, I remember that Flair reveal was anticlimactic. And that's thanks, guys. Great show from Job Gunson. So thank you very much for the question there. Appreciate it. So the Black Scorpion, this is a classic WCW moment, or not moment, but thing that happened, or angle, or it failed. I don't know what to call it. I'm lost for words. But
by the way, because I'll probably put this as an audio drop, and I meant to mention it's in my notes here, from the Thunder Cage with Muda, that one, when he goes to escape, and JR says, you better watch out because he'll become a fried wonton. And I was just shaking my head at the 80s casual racism, as always.
Muda would like to, I guess, go to the land of the rising sun right now. He may be fried wonton if he gets all of that talk very strongly.
But that line made me laugh, and I had a note here. I meant to put it down. It's just awful, awful stuff.
Oh god, JR. Yeah, sometimes he doesn't have great moments in that era. So getting back to the Black Scorpion, he debuted in August 1990 when it was still NWA under the NWA banner, and he was taunting in vignette Sting, wasn't he? And these were sinister things. We didn't know who the Black Scorpion was, and he had creepy music played over it, but he did allude to a few things, didn't he, JT?
Oh, he did. he would mention "Remember Me from California," you know, like stuff like that, and basically saying that he's someone from Sting's past. And there's some ridiculous ones that we'll probably touch on in here, but at one point he literally just says like, "I want your life," and I don't know if he meant like he felt like he should have what Sting has, or does he mean he literally wants to take his life? Like, I'm not sure what he means, if he's trying to kill the guy or if he's saying that, you know, basically you got what should have been mine kind of thing, which would makes more sense to me because it plays into the whole former partner, former friend that, you know, I think he's probably accusing Sting of stabbing him in the back and going out on his own and leaving him behind. That's what it seemed to be.
While everybody, including the horsemen, are chasing you, there's a big difference. Sid wants your belt. I want your life.
So it was a bit of a daft angle. We had Ole Anderson playing him, didn't we? In the actual Shrouded Mystery one, but then we had different Black Scorpions appearing at different times. Mm-hmm. JT, we had his debut at Clash 12 on September the 5th, 1990. There's different people played him, but this one was interesting. People are saying it was Al Perez. We've had other guys who have allegedly played him: Jeff Ellis, Wild Bill Irwin, David Sheldon, Ric Flair. Obviously, we get to that. Stan Payne, Barry Windham, Jumping Joey Janela.
Mags, you mean?
Mags, yeah. Why have I put Jumping Joey Jamel? Oh my god. Randy
I don't think he's been around that long. I don't know.
No, and Randy Colley, Moondog Rex as well, played him, but it was kind of hokey, wasn't it? You had a guy under a mask come out, and then they did really poor magician's tricks. You know, really well, they weren't that bad, but I think they didn't have the budget for it, because there was an interview with the magician who did the actual tricks for WCW. He was on the 605 podcast maybe about 4 or 5 months ago, and that's quite a cool interview, getting how he got hired, what he was told about it all. So check that out, 605pod.com. It's a really cool interview that Brian Last did. But getting back to the whole angle, though, it was alluded to as someone from his past. That was going to be, like you said, Ultimate Warrior. He was from his past.
Who was, by the way, WWF champion at this time. So, I mean, it's ridiculous that they were even kind of teasing it. And I remember, like, Meltzer, or reading, I mean, God, going back when I read through the old Herb Coons tidbits archive, who basically just ripped shit from Meltzer. I remember him mentioning it in there at this time, like, could it be the Ultimate Warrior? I mean, he is world champion. Like, that was, like, a rumor going around at the time. Can you imagine the world champion from WWF leaving to go play this guy in view at Sting?
I know, it just not working, completely bait and switch. The other guy was Dave Sheldon. He was also his former training partner, and he was also in that Power Team USA in the mid-80s. There was Sting, there was, as we said, Ultimate Warrior, Hellwig. I've forgotten off the top of my head who the guy who was the kind of brains behind it. He was involved in kind of the California wrestling scene for years and years. The name will come to me in a minute. But yeah, it was people from his past, let's just say. And I think the classic thing about this was they contacted the Angel of Death to come in after, I think, they'd already started the angles. So WCW didn't actually have anyone in place to play this in classic WCW fashion. So they contacted the Angel of Death. They didn't come to an agreement on contract, so they didn't really have anyone at this point. So I think they panicked a bit. So they had on house shows, you had the Black Scorpion working Sting on house shows, but Sting could never unmask him because Sting kept getting attacked by Sid Vicious.
Right.
You know, so the Black Scorpion escaped. So in the end, we had Ric Flair playing the Black Scorpion, didn't we? That was what they went to in the end. And that didn't make any sense. He was from Sting's past. You know,
I guess he was, but
so was a lot of people then. Yeah. Anyone that wrestled Sting or, you know, feuded with him.
I mean, I guess if you wanted to really stretch your mind, you could say, well, they were teammates in the Horsemen, but the California stuff doesn't make sense. I mean, it's clear that they completely just didn't give a shit and just wanted it over with, because Flair gets unmasked, loses, and like that's it. They never talk about it again. So you could tell, like, by that point, they didn't care about any of the backstory or give a shit about making it connect at all. It just had to be a mind games by Flair because they had nothing else to do. And I actually thought it wasn't like a really bad, like the early stuff wasn't bad. Like even the promos and vignettes, yes, he's got the shroud and the voice, but like the stuff he was saying wasn't a bad story. Like, all right, this guy from his past coming for him, Sting's on top of the world now, he got left behind and he wants her. Like, that's a classic story, right? And the way they're doing it's okay. And then It just goes way off the rails when they start the magic. Like, he goes from being this mysterious, ominous guy from Sting's past to somehow being a fucking parlor magician that should be working. You know, he's making tigers appear and move around, and people move from one podium to the next. And Sting has to sell all this nonsense. And, like, I just don't know what – I don't know. I mean, it predated all the Undertaker theatrics, I guess. But it was just a really weird – decision. And my favorite of all the promos is Gordon Soley going to visit him in his lair. And WCW was a big fan of lairs. All their evil guys live in lairs, but he goes to visit them in the lair, and he's like blindfolded because the Scorpion doesn't want him to find out his identity. And they're doing this awkward camera shot where they're like squished in next to each other, and Soley, it's like they're at like JCPenney or something, like the photo studio, trying to take like a family portrait the way they're seated. It's just, the whole thing is weird.
And now, as I promised you earlier, let's go to the most bizarre interview I have ever conducted. Talk about being in the dark. I was.
Bring Gordon in, please. Gordon, I hope that you found your trip to your liking.
Well, I frankly got to say this is the most demeaning thing I've ever gone through. Why all the secrecy?
You don't have to say anything. I brought you here to deliver a message. But I will grant you some time in which you may ask me some questions.
Well, first of all, why the blindfold?
To keep my identity a secret. You're the only person other than Sting who has been this close to the Black Scorpion.
Well, all right, the question is, and of course it's on everybody's mind, you've made these comments, but you've never said what the real reason behind your wishing to get at Sting.
I don't have to tell you. I don't have to tell anybody. The idea is for Sting to think. I want Sting to be driven mad. I want Sting to look back on his life. Remember, Gordon, Sting and I at one time knew each other. Very well, I might add.
Well, that was in California, if I remember correctly, that you made the statement.
Well, I said California, but ask Sting this. Ask Sting about Tulsa.
Tulsa?
Yes, Tulsa, Gordon. See what he says. Look at his reaction. Maybe he'll remember something.
Well, very frankly, if you don't mind, Scorpion, I
do mind.
Well,
I think our interview is almost over.
Yeah, say what Gordon, you have to say and let me go, please.
Well, Gordon, consider yourself lucky. You will be able to leave the clutches of the Black Scorpion. Sting won't be quite so lucky. Remember, Sting, while Sid is after your belt, I'm after your soul.
Soli, like, doesn't seem concerned, the fact that he's blindfolded in this guy's lair, like, that he could kill him. He's on record of wanting to take Sting's life, but here's Soli just kind of nonchalantly talking to him while blindfolded. That was my favorite of all the skits. But the magic stuff is where it went completely to shit.
Yeah, the magic stuff was hokey as hell. And when he did appear on TV, he was dressed like in a monk's robe sometimes, with like a belt made out of rope.
It just
didn't work. I think the idea for Flair doing it kind of worked. Well, it didn't work as such, but Flair was off TV. He did the kidnapping angle with Teddy Long, feuding with Doom. So it was kind of at that time out of sight, out of mind. And when he was in the mask, he cut his hair so it would actually fit under the mask, and he was wrestling in an indistinct style as well, so he wasn't doing the pattern Flair stuff. But I think the reason for this, the backstory was, they didn't feel Sting was doing a good job with the title, so, you know, they felt they were going to go back to Flair. If this isn't work, let's go back to Flair. But Sting basically felt, I want something before I lose, you know, the title to Sting. I want a victory. I want something. So that was kind of the backstory or the reason behind it. So Flair agreed to do it. And then he was unmasked. And then, you know, Sting dropped the belt in 91. So
it's ironic that the better story that they could have told had to do with these former teammates, Sting and Ultimate Warrior, both being champions at the same time and struggling. Obviously, they couldn't tell the story, but to me, that's way more interesting than what they ended up doing, that you have these two guys, both came up at the same time, former tag team partners, both ascend, muscle-bound guys that ascend at the same time to win the title in their promotion after, you know, working their way up in 89, and by the fall of 90, both world title reigns are on life support. And it's amazing, because you would think the Iraqi stuff with Slaughter and Warrior was maybe the, you know, worst of the storylines, but somehow I think that was better than the Black Scorpion that Sting had to deal with. But I just thought it's kind of a cool comparison when you look at the two guys and where they were at that time.
Yeah, this is moving, this is late 1990. So, do you know, I mentioned in the previous episode that I felt WCW was a bit more serious in ring in 89 and 90. Yeah. But it's definitely at the tail end of 90. We got more of these hokey things like this. And looking back on it, we can laugh at it now. We can do podcasts on it like this one. But at the time, I can imagine hardcore fans really hated this. If you go back and read the Observers, read the letters, it's just getting buried left, right, and centre.
I'm sure.
And at that time, you can understand why.
Especially
so,
once the magic came in, that's when it just got ridiculous.
Yeah, it just wasn't great at all. But in the playlist, again, there's plenty of examples of some hokey magic in there, so people can check that out. So it's that time of the week, JT. As always, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go and get my keys, get my car out of my garage, and get on the road.
Let's do it, because it is time for the 1-800-COLLECT Road Report with the Chap Call Down, looking back at this week in WCW history.
Well, this week I'm at the Pacific Coliseum in Vancouver, British Columbia. I am at the WCW New Blood Rising pay-per-view, where there were 6,614 in attendance with just 85,000 pay-per-view buys, down 15,000 from the previous month's Bash at the Beach. And it was down 235,000 buys from the event that was at the previous time the year before, which was Road Wild in 99. So, wow, WCW had really, you know, this is falling off a cliff time, isn't it, JT?
Yeah, yeah, not good. I mean, we're still in the Bischoff-Russo era, you know, and I mean, they're trying, right? They're trying to push some of the young guys and the whole theory behind the new blood rising and all that, but people just aren't watching at this point. WWF is red hot. The Rock is on top. Even with Austin gone, this is The Rock and Triple H on top in 2000. The product is just molten hot in everywhere in pop culture. We talked about that a couple episodes ago, how WCW 97 was starting to pop up, you know, t-shirts and gimmicks and gadgets everywhere. WWF just dominating everything now in 2000. Like, their stuff is everywhere. T-shirts everywhere, all over MTV. And, you know, that was another one of my barometers. Like, who was MTV working with? You know, it was WCW 97. Now it's 2000. It's WWF. So, like, that's how you know who the hot promotion is. But everywhere you'd go, you'd see shirts. And, you know, being on a college campus, it was really starting to blow up. And WCW was just lagging. But, you know, you look at the numbers, and it's funny because, you know, for 2000, WCW, you're thinking is dog shit. But it's, if you really look at later years, like, it's, you know, companies would, you know, kill for this at that time. But it doesn't look as bad in retrospect. Even their Nitro ratings, you look back at this time period, it's like, oh, God, they were terrible at the time. But they were still pulling, like, low threes and high twos, which is crazy. But
Yeah,
the card itself is interesting. This is the one that was in Canada. So they went heavy with, like, the Landstorm stuff. And this is the one that we had mentioned, too, in the past, where Jacques Rougeau was the guest referee. They had teased Bret Hart, and then Bret comes out anyway, and the Canadians all kind of hug. And just the yeah. This was really meant to be a turning, you know, turnkey show as far as, like, ushering in the young out with the old. If you look at the main event, it's Booker T winning or retaining the WCW title over Jarrett, two of their quote-unquote young guys that they were pushing. Booker was the new face of the promotion. It was the month before that Hogan was turfed after the whole thing where Russo shot on him. So, like, Hogan's gone. You know, Flair's not really in the mix as much right now. Sting's in the undercard battling the Deadpool guys. You're sticking Nash and Goldberg and those guys all together. But, of course, they go ahead and do the stupid shoot finish in that because Russo can't help himself, and that's where it's Nash versus Steiner versus Goldberg. Goldberg comes out after being out in a motorcycle accident, comes in, and then shoots on what the finish was supposed to be. I think he was, what, does he get up and walk away or something? It says,
yeah,
I'm not laying
like,
down.
He's in enough, and then he walks out. It is lame as hell, that terrible one. And, you know, that's just Russo can't help it. And also, here we have one of the most infamous WCW matches on the undercard. Buff Bagwell defeated Canyon in a Judy Bagwell on a forklift match.
You know, it's funny, we didn't talk about that. I meant, when I listened back to our one where we talked about the years, or we talked about 2000, we completely forgot about Judy Bagwell. And actually, as early as 98, she's around. But This is ridiculous. I mean, she's tag champion at one point. But yes, here she is hoisted up on a forklift for Bagwell and Kanyon to fight over. Yeah. I mean, the highlight is the opener, the three count versus the Young Dragons in the ladder match. Like, that's a really good match. Like, they have good stuff. And this is Kidman, Shane Douglas, too. They have the strap match, but this is during the whole Viagra feud with Torrey Wilson. Just awful. Yeah. And the whole, everything is just a mess. I mean, it's the worst of Russo just cluttering up what still is a decent roster. Like, if you look at the names on this card alone, like, they could have cobbled together a pretty good show still, but it's just, you know, you got Russo out there doing Russo things.
Yeah, definitely Russo doing Russo things. We had like the Great Muta. He loses to Ernest Miller and took a match on the show, and then he wins the tag titles later on the show with Vampiro against Chronic. So,
and you got Ray as a referee. You know, like, it's just stupid. Like, we're the, yeah, it's just dumb.
Yeah, so this show, it's not one that I really remember apart from the bad stuff. It was also the third worst show of the year according to Observer, you know, and the year awards. The other two were WCW shows as well, which were Super Bowl and Halloween Havoc respectively. So it's not a great show. You can go back, you can laugh, point, see Russo's booking, remind Russo on Twitter why he's the shits. You know, if you watch this, he may take credit for it, may be proud of it, but it's not a show that I really have fond memories of myself.
No, it's not his fault. It's WCW's fault. They put the restrictions on him, Alan. Come on.
Oh, yeah, of course. So that's about the most we're going to talk about New Blood Rising, which was this week, August the 13th, 2000. So shall we move on to the last question, the long topic of the show, JT?
Let's do it.
Okie doke. Dear Alan and JT, what is your favourite or most random only WCW could have booked match with international wrestlers? And that's from Blue Ray Mysterio, who's put himself in brackets as Zony winner, Jesus lover, cheese lover, and pasta eater, maker of bad jokes and great plugger. So okay, thank you very much there for the question there, Blue Ray Mysterio. So some matches here, JT. I've put them all on the playlist, ones I really dig that I could find that have featured international talent, because I've got a separate playlist that I may link and give you the link to put in the show notes, is the best of WCW shows. So we had loads of random matches. But specifically with international talent, this is what we're focusing on this show. So I watched a few matches, and I had some fun doing them. So the first match I watched was Blacktop Bully versus El Dandy. And that was from the October the 2nd, 1999 Saturday night. And wow, Blacktop Bully, this is awesome. He's in the back. El Dandy comes out, and then Blacktop Bully's in the back, and he cuts a promo.
This is going to be a basically topic someday, I hope. Go ahead.
So he's not announced as Blacktop Bully. He's announced as Hole in One Darso. Mm-hmm. So in the back, he's saying, "No, I'm not. I'm Blacktop Bully." And he comes out and he's shouting, "I'm Blacktop Bully," when he comes out through the curtain. And Mike Tenay on commentary remarks that he's Crusher Khrushchev. So he's doing the whole, "Look at me, I've done a million gimmicks" kind of gimmick at the time. And he's out this week as Blacktop Bully, who we'd last seen, I would have said, was he 94 or 95? He did the kind of feud with Dustin Rhodes.
Early 95, and that's when Dustin got fired, and he pretty much gets shit canned too. I think they both get fired, but he it's funny too, because they're like, oh, and that's the names we can't mention legally or something too, because that obviously they were teasing like Demolition Smash, like those are just the ones we can say without getting sued. They were joking about that a lot too, but yeah, I like this whole thing where they're like, Hole in One Darso, where is he? And they go back and he's doing his Blacked Out Bully gimmick. And yeah, it was funny, because I think, doesn't he end up running through, like, a bunch of them throughout this? Doesn't he come out as Crusher Khrushchev at one point, too, during this whole thing?
Yes. Yeah, he does. He comes out of different gimmicks. That's the whole idea of this. I mean, in this one, his Blacktop Bully looks like, you know, someone's dad who likes a few beers at the weekend, you know, and gets wrecked and has a fight in a, you know, out in a parking lot somewhere. And have you always noticed with Barry Darso, he always likes to talk out the corner of his mouth. You know, like, yeah, he's doing that all over this show as well. And in this match, El Dandy hits one of the worst drop kicks I've ever seen. It's just not very good at all. Even though El Dandy's, you know, a great worker, or a legendary worker, in the times of his career. On this match as well, Scott Hudson, just his commentary just rubs me up the wrong way. I'm not, you know, like we touched on our favourite commentators and least favourite commentators in the last show, JT. I mean, I was listening to this, it's something about him, he just rubs me up the wrong way. He just comes out with just shit, you know, out of his mouth. So I'm not a fan of him in this one.
Yeah.
And in the end, Darso makes El Dandy tap to some kind of Zack Sabre Jr. wacky wrist lock. But overall, the style clash wasn't too bad at all. And, you know, it didn't stand out as a really bad mix of styles. I mean, Blacktop Bully Barry Darso, he's been around for, at this point, 16, 17-year veteran. So he's seen it all, done it all. So I think he was a good hand. And him versus El Dandy, I don't think it was ever going to be too bad. This, I would probably give this about 2 stars if I was going to rate it. So that's my first random international match. And the second one I watched... through when I was doing the research was a guy called Andy Lewis versus Gedo. I have no idea who Andy Lewis is. I didn't actually bother to go and look him up on Cage Match, JT. So while I'm talking through this, would you do me a favor and go and quickly look up who Andy Lewis was? Out of interest, just for me, if that's okay. So this match, Andy Lewis versus Gedo, who's now the New Japan booker or co-booker with Jado. Interestingly, his career, hell of a long career, debuted in the late 80s, early 90s, wrestled FMW, Wing, War, and in the end he got the shot being the New Japan booker because literally no one else really wanted to do it. He'd been a fan of he studied the US style for a number of years, even subscribed to the Wrestling Observer newsletter in the early 90s, so he had his finger on the pulse for the US scene. So he came over in 97, he worked the match with Chris Jericho at Halloween Havoc that year. I think that was the match where Gedo nearly killed Chris Jericho with a top rope Hurricane Rana, and he landed on his head.
That happens to a lot of Jericho, in fairness.
Yeah, no, that's fair, it does. I mean, in this match, he's managed by Sonny Ono. He comes out to the generic stock Japanese generic music. And he doesn't have his shit haircut around this time either. You know, the one where his sides are all, you know, shaved, and he has the, right, the top in the ponytail. A bit like a Rob Van Dam haircut, but worse. If that's possible. So he comes out, he's got a kind of dyed, very short crew cut, blonde crew cut, and he comes out, he's got a mean look on his face, and he's wearing his classic Gedo pyjamas that he's always worn. I used to sport a nice red pair of these pyjamas in War in the early 90s, and also I think he appeared at the New Japan Super J Cup in the pyjamas as well. But here we are in 97, he's fighting Andy Lewis. Like I said, JT, I have no idea who he was.
Nothing on Cage Match for Andy Lewis.
Well, there we go. He's someone
unknown.
I'm going to have to look him up. I'm going to have to look him up after the show. There'll be some information on him. Or if, guys, if you listen to this and you want to send in the information, if you know it, send it our way. So Gedo wins with a Gedo clutch pretty much quickly. All in all, it's a nothing match. Again, not many, you know, not much of a style clash. But why have we got a guy that we have no information about versus Gedo on main event in that, you know, in 97? That's just, you know, throwing two guys together. I don't think there was much thought about.
No, it amazes me, too, the guys they'd bring in and then use on these shows. Like, you know, like the Gedo using him here, and like you don't ever see him like on Nitro Thunder, really. You know, they, like, you just brought him in for these shows. Like, they could have gotten anyone in the country to fill, but they're bringing guys in from all over the world to just wrestle meaningless matches on their C shows that they never even reference anywhere else. You know what I mean? Like, it's so random the way they did their thought process. And I mean, I'm glad they do it because it gives us so much fun stuff to go back and look at. Like, it's really cool. Like, Ric Flair versus Lismark on Worldwide. Like, that's a super fun, just random match out there just from, like, a trivia point of view, you know? Like, it's just stuff like that was always intriguing to me. Like, I always like when they would have a big-name guy take on a random name guy that's on a lower level, but it's still, like, a cool matchup that's not just a jobber. Like, that stuff always was cool to me, like, on the weekend shows when they would do stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, I've always felt WCW did that a lot better than WWF.
Yeah.
Throughout the 90s. You'd have two guys, you know, you might have an up-and-comer like a Marcus Bagwell versus Lex Luger or something on a TV show. You know, there's plenty of hope spots. Bagwell gets his shit in. Luger ultimately wins, but it doesn't make Bagwell look bad. He's competing with Luger. So there's reasons why they did these type of matches rather than squash matches. And I was a fan of these. And I was also, like you said, JT, a fan of the massive random pairings that they had. Like another one here in 97 on Worldwide, we had the amazing French Canadians versus Doc Dean and Robbie Brookside, two the Liverpool lads from who obviously famous in here in the UK, wrestled a hell of a lot in the 90s. They did a few tours in New Japan as well around this time. And we had the amazing French Canadians in this match. They were managed by Colonel Robert Parker, as you know, and he comes out in a French Foreign Legion outfit, you know, which I think looks awesome for him. But yeah, he's not playing the Southern Gentleman. Obviously he is, but he's cosplaying as a Foreign Legion, right, from the French Foreign Legion, which is quite an amazing look on this one. So that was a kind of random match. We also had matches like Jeff Jarrett versus Psychosis. You know, what a style clash. You know, the Memphis Jeff Jarrett, you know, coming from that kind of background versus the Lucha Psychosis. And they mentioned this match. Tony Schiavone mentioned that Psychosis was a top contender for every major title in WCW. So
the king of hyperbole, Tony Schiavone.
So that was a fun match. But is there any that you briefly saw or that you can kind of touch on from the research, JT?
Yeah, no, I think you covered a lot of them, and the playlist is filled with them, so be sure to check it out this week. I did enjoy La Parca and Silver King versus Curly Bill, who's Virgil, of course, and Kendall Windham. Some more randomness. And that's a cool thing when they had a lot of those Lucha guys in there, because they would just throw them out on all these random shows, and they would get pushed according to the show. Like, if you watch a Saturday Night or Worldwide, those guys were, like, bigger stars, whereas on Nitro, they were job fodder or in the Cruiserweight division. But, like, a guy like a Silver King or an El Dandy, they were kind of like legends on Saturday Night when they'd come out. You know, there was so much more just presented in a different light on those shows, which is why I always thought it was cool. I thought WCW did do a very good job with the variants on their different shows and leveraging the depth of their roster on those shows, whereas Nitro... You know, if you watch Nitro on, like, the network in order, which I'm doing, you may see a lot of these guys, but you don't really get the full grasp and appreciation for just how deep their roster was. And if you were to watch, like, Saturday Night and Worldwide, it would almost feel like two different promotions at this time, from, like, 97, 98, 99. There's so much just different stuff out there on those shows. And they would touch on the big angles, and you'd occasionally get the big guys, but it was so much of this just random stuff out there pushing guys that you'd never see on Nitro. It's like, it's crazy to me, but it's so good.
Oh, yeah, there was various times in WCW's history that the syndicated shows were a different universe than the main shows, like Saturday Nights or later on your Nitros. I mean, there's a great match that is on the playlist as well. We've got Kazuki Sasaki, who comes in. This would have been 90... I don't know. I don't actually know when this would have been. Looking at because I've got this on now in the background. It's on the playlist. It's Kazuki Sasaki versus Chick Donovan. Wow, that's just like what a mixture of two different worlds there colliding. And looking at the WCW ring, this may have been 92, where you had some of the New Japan guys who were coming in for the tag tournaments and things like that. But that's a definitely a mix of styles. I would have loved to see the Gambler work different weeks against different Lucha guys, right? Different luchadors. I think that would have been a fun time, the Gambler going up against different ones. But we didn't unfortunately see that. The match I've got on the playlist was against Mr. JL. I know Jerry Lynn was an American guy, but it was a different style than what the Gambler had. It was more of a high-flying style. So that was kind of cool, look at two different styles there. But yeah, there was such a mix of different ones. Like you said, La Parca and Silver King versus Virgil, so Curly Bill and Kendall William. We had like a High Voltage versus Volano 4 and Super Callo. And this one as well, JT, I forgot about this one. It is on the playlist. It's Jushin Liger versus Jimmy Jam Garvin.
Yeah.
We all like to do the Jimmy Jam Garvin impression. But yeah, this one, completely clash of styles. They do not cope well together whatsoever. So that is probably, to answer Blue Ray Mysterio's question, this was probably the most random clash of styles of matches that you could see. And this is, like I said, on the playlist. So you can check this out. You can also check out the random WCW matches playlist that I've put together that I think we'll link in the show notes, because that's worth checking out for so many more different random matches. But yeah, there's plenty to go off there, so definitely, guys, check that out. So it's been quite a rapid show this week, JT. We've kind of cut through the questions quite quickly.
Yeah, it was a good time, though. I like when we can humble along, and I thought we had some good variants on our discussion. You know, we touched on cages, we touched on Scorpion, Black Scorpions, we touched on New Blood, and now we've hit up on some random WCW match. I think we covered, like, a good cross-section of what WCW was about. Like, everything we talked about tonight is, like, a perfect illustration of their whole existence. But, yeah, I mean, get those questions, keep them coming in, Alan. Why don't you tell everyone where they can submit?
Okay, submit the questions. A few ways you can do that. You can do that via Twitter. You can tweet us at Alan_Cheapshot. That's A-L-L-A-N. You can tweet JT at @place2BENation. You can email us at letters from centerstage@gmail.com. Or you can use the discuss function on the Place to Be Nation post for the shows which come out each and every Friday. You can post under there. I will comment if I see them. You can join the chat on there. That's pretty cool. There's been a few people that have gone that way, that route to answer questions. To ask questions. So we'll always keep an eye out there. So all in all, there's plenty of ways you can ask the questions into the show. And we do encourage you, send the questions in. We do love doing them. The more the merrier, different variants of topics. There may be certain niche things you want us to cover, like the careers of certain guys, like the career of Curly Bill in WCW, not just, you know, him as Vincent or anything like that. We could kind of go through that. Like we've done Life of Times on Letters from Kayfabe with Parv of Virgil. So maybe we could do a question, the Life of Times of Vincent and all these other ones in WCW. I think that'd be a cool topic in the future. So there's plenty more topics we can cover. We've like we say every week, we've barely scratched the surface, have we, JT, on what we can discuss on these shows.
Oh, there's so much stuff to talk about still. Every time we like barely reference, like with the Judy Bagwell, like that's a whole show if we want. There's so much other stuff just buried in here. But then we haven't talked about the West Texas Rednecks yet. We're talking about the Nolan Soldiers. We didn't talk about their rivals. There's so much alone from like 2000 in WCW that we could just spend years on in 91. Just those two years alone. So, yeah, we got plenty of roads still to cover. And be sure to follow us on social media for all of your updates. Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Place2BNation on Twitter. Also, PlaceToBeNation.com. We have discussion threads and comments open on every post. So be sure to join us there at the chat each and every day. And iTunes, subscribe to our feeds. PlaceToBeNation Wrestling, PlaceToBeNation Pop, Pro Wrestling Only. All three of those you'll get each and every show. Rate us and leave feedback as well. So that'll do it for the chap to call Alan. I'm JT. We'll be back next Friday with another trip around the WCW mothership. Until then, everyone take care.
Adios.
Yo, baby, yo, baby, yo!
At the Mahler, completely maul his opponent, Steve Dahl.
What I've heard.
What's that shit, your softball game?
Light Magazine called it the Harvard of professional wrestling.
They're great.
Always go swimming with a buddy. Work real hard and always study.
The Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's a guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot.
You red-headed booger, you.
Is it spread?
Yes.
You can't find your scissors.